We have special news for you.
The forgotten men and women of our country will be forgotten no longer.
Are you going to send me or anybody that I know to a camp?
We have people that are stupid.
The facts for kids.
Oh, Rob!
Well,
Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
It's the Ricochet Podcast with Larry Kudlow as Rob Long and John Gabriel as Peter Robinson. I'm James Lilex, and we'll be talking to James Rosen of Fox News. Let's have ourselves a podcast. Bye-bye. Welcome, everybody. This is the Ricochet Podcast, number 338. And we're brought to you by Lyft. You know about Lyft, right? It's the app that gets you a ride in minutes like that, on demand, 24/7, for less than the cost of a cab. Now, you can download the free Lyft app today and enter the promo code Ricochet in the payment section. You'll start with three free rides, up to $10 each. That's $30 in value. We'll tell you a little bit about that later as well. And we're brought to you by Casper Mattress. Welcome back, Casper. Get the best night's sleep you possibly can. I can vouch for that for personal experience. And you can get $50 towards any mattress purchase by visiting casper.com/ricochet and using what would be the promo code there? Ricochet, right. And we're brought to you by SimpliSafe. You can protect your home the smart way without the expense of long-term contracts using SimpliSafe Home Security. So visit simplisafe.com/ricochet. That's SimpliSafe.com/ricochet. And we're also, of course, brought to you by Ricochet itself. We'd like to thank everybody in the Slate Panoply Network for tuning into this. And if you're wondering what this is exactly, Ricochet is the place on the web for smart, center-right, civil conversation. And you can be one of the people who are signing up to Ricochet to enjoy things like, well, the member feed, where there's all kinds of bumptious, interesting, fascinating, you know, riotous conversation going on between people who are generally on the same page but love to have a good intellectual mix-up. While you're at it, when you go to Ricochet, you might also want to subscribe to The Daily Shot, which is a daily email newsletter. It gives you some laughs and keeps you tabs on all. It'll also help you speak, which is something that I need. So here to help me speak are other people from Ricochet. John Gabriel. John, hello. Welcome. And we welcome back, of course, the great Larry Kudlow, who's sitting in for Rob and Peter. And really, there's no one he can replace because he's so unique and welcome. So, hey, guys, how are you?
It's a task I'll never achieve, but I'll try.
Do you want to be Rob Long this week, or do you want to be Peter Robinson? I'll let you guys fight that out.
Well, I already have a sweater tied around my neck, so Peter's role.
I want to merge Rob Long with Peter. I've always wanted to do that, actually.
Oh, that was a movie with Rosie Grier and Ray Milland, and I'm having thoughts about it. Here's the story of the week. Apparently, we're now at war with Mexico. And I've been hearing everybody say that we're having a 20% tax on all Mexican goods. And then I have economists in my Twitter feed waving their hands and saying, no. This is a border adjustment tax that was actually something the GOP had in the works a while ago. It's not a 20% tax on Mexican goods. It's more complex than that. Larry, help me out here. Is it a tariff? Is it a tax? Is it none of the above? Is it revenue neutral? What is going on with this proposal?
Well, for one thing, it is pretty complicated, and basically, I don't like the idea, whatever we're going to call it. It is a tax, it is a tariff, and it's not a good idea at all. And I'm pleased that my friend Steve Forbes has been actively campaigning against it, actually running a full-page ad in the Wall Street Journal. Look, there's a couple of things here worth talking about. Number one, if American companies relocate to Mexico in order to sell their goods to America duty-free, I don't like that, okay? I think that's a bad arbitrage. That's all they're doing. They're arbitraging taxes and tariff. Mexico has a 16% VAT. That applies to Mexican goods and sales. That also applies to imports. The United States does not have a VAT, and I hope we never do have a VAT. However, I agree with Mr. Trump on one key point. You can't just move from Detroit to Monterey or wherever in order to escape any taxation at all. So regarding that small issue, that's the small issue, okay? Something has to be done. Now, I think business tax reform is the answer, not of that or anything else. But I'll put that aside and say that is an issue. On the other hand, what was in the Republican proposal, the House proposal, is something I just can't buy into yet. They're basically saying globally we will tax imports and we will subsidize exports. And I think that's a perfectly terrible European, Asian type model, which will not produce economic growth. Let markets sort out imports and exports. And by the way, let's not forget, if you slap an import tax, you are going to hose, damage, destroy all the middle and lower income wage earners, who, by the way, voted for Donald Trump, who shop at Walmart and other big box stores. You're going to jack up their prices substantially. You're going to impoverish them in so doing. You're also going to wreck our entire energy system, which is fully integrated with Mexico and Canada. You'll never figure out how to do this with things like car parts and other content materials. It's impossible. But where it will go in the longer term is it will produce, in my judgment, another tax, namely a value-added tax or a national sales tax on top of our income tax and state and local taxes. And I don't want that. I want fewer taxes and I want lower marginal tax rates, which Mr. Trump has exactly right in his business tax reform package. But on this one, heck no. Count me out. It'll never work. And by the way, the McLaughlin brothers, John and Jim McLaughlin, did some polling on this, and nearly 60% of Americans disapprove of import taxes.
Was it in the bill in the works before Trump, though? I mean, when people are saying that this was part of a GOP tax proposal, are there voices in the party outside of Mr. Trump that predated Mr. Trump that said that this is what we want to do?
Well, wait, Trump has not said it's what he wants to do. We'll come back to that in a minute. But yes, it was never in Trump's plan. It was always in the House Republican plan. By the way, very unpopular, but it was in there. Yes.
Hmm. Well, when you say
what you've got, what you've got going on here is a lot of confusion, number one. And this very badly needs to be sorted out, along with the somewhat frazzled Mexican policy in general. But Trump avoided this in his tax plan, which Steve Moore and I helped draft last summer and fall. And I'm glad he did. But the point is, let's just be real simple. You want to grow the economy. You want to get us from less than 2% to above 3%. Let's first, as Steve Moore and I wrote in this morning's Wall Street Journal editorial page, let us pass in the next 100 days a business tax cut for large and small companies. Let's have repatriation. Let's have a 15 to 20% corporate tax rate for large and small companies. Let's have cash expensing for investment. That will make America the most hospitable investment destination in the world, and our companies will have no need to play these tax and tariff arbitrage games. Let's just get that done. It should be priority number one. That's the way to get this done.
Priority number two is talking to John Gabriel, who's patiently waiting. John, hello. How has this week struck you? Did you think that what's going on, tariffs, tax, the war, the border, et cetera, is being expertly and correctly reported?
Oh, who could find any fault in the media and how they're covering Trump? Just very rational, calm. They just take a deep breath and try to focus on the facts. Now, what's been tricky of keeping up with the news is trying to interpret, trying to divine the truth behind the insane reports. You know, it started with the reporter, the pool reporter, who insisted that the first thing Trump did was remove MLK's bust from the Oval Office, but it was behind a door and he couldn't see it. And everything he does, it's just provoking such an insane, unhinged reaction by all comers. I don't know what the media thinks it's doing. I don't know when there is a real crisis, when there's a situation like war or even building a wall or talking about taxes and tariffs, how people can trust them. So they're really shooting themselves in the foot with this. The latest outrage, since I live my life on Twitter, I spend way too much time on there, but you have the National Park Service basically subtweeting Donald Trump, trying to undercut him, talking about climate change. And the press is furious because Trump said, oh, okay, we'll stop tweeting until we figure this out. He's their boss. And why it's an attack on freedom of speech to for these departments to basically say what he would like them to say is kind of an odd thing to figure out. I know that they weren't promoting anti-Bush sentiments on Twitter when Bush was in office. So everybody just needs to calm down, wait for the facts, look at the facts. And if people keep chasing these crowd sizes and various squirrels that run and distract people, they're only killing their own credibility when real issues worthy of debate do come up, because they always do.
And what would those be to you? In other words, I like you, I spend too much time on Twitter, and I've seen these things explode too. But to them, it's indicative of the new age, of a very dark new age, of a troublesome era in which the government is cracking down and taking away. Why, there are EPA climate scientists who are coming to work in tears. There are databanks that are being erased, proving that because Trump doesn't believe in climate. These people think that there's actually real, horrible 1936-level stuff going on here.
Well, I think if you want to brand yourself, if you're Mother Jones or the New Republic, fine. Take that perspective. You know, you'll have Breitbart on the right, Ricochet on the center right. You'll have liberal organs as well. But if you want to position yourself, you know, I come from kind of a media background. And if you want to position yourself as we're the arbiters of truth, CNN, the most trusted name in news, then tell both stories and don't automatically assume when Obama makes a confusing decision that you don't have all the facts on, that it's probably a good thing, which they did for the past 8 years. And then when Trump issues a directive, it's automatically a bad thing. And it's obviously just like Hitler. There was a reporter on Twitter a day or two ago, once the Dow hit 20,000, she said, well, just remember that under Hitler, the stock market went up too. And you know how that turned out.
Who said this?
Oh, gosh. I cannot recall her name. I will search it in a bit. But it's insanity. I have a dog, and Hitler had a dog too. So come on.
Was it Anne Applebaum? No. Okay. Larry, I'll ask you. Do you think a lot of this could be avoided, of course, if the president maybe didn't tweet it as much as he did about certain things that people wish he wouldn't say? Do you believe this is part of his brilliant strategy to go over the head of the media, or perhaps there are times when maybe he not should tweet things?
You know, I just say this. I like the idea of tweeting to go over the heads of the media. I'm perfectly happy with that. But I just want to add here, we're kind of going south here. We're kind of taking the dark side of the conversation. And I just want to inject my view that Donald Trump is having a very, very good first week, okay? That doesn't mean there aren't some glitches. But the reality is the guy is showing incredible energy in pursuit of the very goals and policies on which he campaigned and won the election handily. I mean, he's talking about tax cuts. He's talking about rolling back regulations. He's talking about the Dakota and Keystone pipelines. He's talking about border security and some much needed immigration reforms. He's going to have a free trade conversation today with the British Prime Minister on a bilateral trade deal. I think Trump is showing the optimism that he indicated in his inaugural speech. Think big, but dream even bigger. Now is the time for action. He is showing America that we can turn this ship around and that American decline can be stopped and we can rise again. I think he's had a terrific first week, albeit maybe a glitch or two that's always around. So I want to give the guy tremendous credit. I want to come out on the high side on this because I think we're all going down the dark road, and I don't really care what CNN says, and I don't care what Hitler's dog's name was. That has no meaning to me whatsoever.
Well, and it was Ann Applebaum, by the way, who tweeted that out. Ann Applebaum, correct. From the Washington Post.
Yeah, and I think you're correct, Larry. Just looking at, we just recently had news, consumer confidence is at a 13-year all-time high post-election. So right. While the media and social media and the internet portray a nation completely riven a step away from the Civil War, we have to understand that most people are getting about their lives and getting to work and saying, hey, I think this is going to turn out. I think we're going to do all right.
I mean, I think Trump is infused. I wrote this in a column. I think Trump has infused the country with a lot of early optimism just in the first couple of days. And I go back to the inaugural. So many people missed the optimism in the inaugural speech. It was not a dark speech. The guy is saying, think big and dream bigger. He's saying the time for action is now. He's saying, don't tell me we can't change these things. Of course we can. This is America. And he's set about it in the first couple days by running through a number of agenda reforms, some of which can be done by executive order. Others are laying out a legislative strategy. He's also talking to the Republicans in the House and Senate. I thought his speech in Philadelphia yesterday, maybe with one glitch, was basically an excellent speech, reviewing an agenda which the Congress and the White House basically agree on, and now they're going to figure out a legislative strategy to get this stuff done. So I think he's turning things around. You're quite right about consumer confidence. I might add to that, small business confidence has actually skyrocketed. The NFIB survey is showing the same thing. And I know stock markets can be fickle, but I think so much of the stock market rally and getting through Dow 20,000 has to do with Trump's early performance, with the tax cuts that he's going to spread to improve business and business investment, which is the heart of the American economy. So my concern is things like speed and strategy, but I think the basic outlines of the new administration and the new president are terrific, and I think he's done a very good job here at the beginning.
Pleased about the things pipeline-related, North Dakotan that I am, this is good. But when the president gets up in front of some business people and says he's going to cut regulations 75%, of course, what the progressives hear is that he's going to personally allow executives to take barrels of molten cadmium and dump them into pristine streams. That's what the progressives hear. What the small business guy hears is, I will be able to open a store in a year instead of three because of all the permits and the regulations that I have to jump through. And that's great. I like that. The more you let the rude animal spirits out of the barn, the more jobs you get, the more economic activity, and the more the cities come back. And I'm looking forward to that. Cutting regulations sounds like a wonderful thing.
Yeah, these are really important things. You're absolutely right. You know, these are really important things. And it's sort of like one of Trump's subliminal messages here is that the war on business is over. And another message is, we intend to reward success, not punish it. I mean, business, large and small, really, I hate to say it, my friend W, who I personally love, but, you know, George W. Bush didn't get that job done. He had huge regulatory increases, not least of which was Sarbanes-Oxley, which had done a lot of damage. America has suffered for, you know, 16 years. We're in a growth rut. But we don't have to stay in a growth rut. And with some simple, direct policy changes, we can fix this and get back to 3 or 4% growth or better. And that's the way I see Trump's message. And I don't care what the far left progressives say. These guys have no message whatsoever except tax rich people, tax rich corporations. They're anti-jobs. They're going to use environmental standards to destroy the economy. So fine, let them hang themselves. And if Chuck Schumer wants to poison the political well at every single turn, which apparently is his strategy, that's going to destroy the Democratic Party, because you know what? Not only does the country want change, the country, in my view, would much prefer to have bipartisan change. And Donald Trump knows how to work with Democrats. So they're going to figure out a way to do this. I think they could get their business tax cuts through, by the by, with about 6 or 8 Democratic votes. And that would be a perfect template for them to move forward on the other issues.
Mm-hmm. You know, Larry, when I was talking about the letting things flourish and letting regulation let other companies, there's all these new ideas that are coming out, right? And the Democrats, the progressives, supposedly the Silicon Valley people, love these things because it's just up their alley. They're smart, they're technological, they're disruptive. But then when some of these things try to get implemented, they run up against entrenched governments in cities that have their own interests and don't want to adapt to a new world. And you find the very thing the progressives worship, which is government, pushing back against the change that supposedly progressives embody. And you find this in things like, well, for example, ride sharing applications. And that's where we come to Lyft. You know about Lyft, don't you? It's that app that gets you a ride in minutes on demand 24/7 for less than the cost of a cab. Of course. Well, we're proud to ask them to join them here as a sponsor. And if you've tried it, well, you know what I mean about Lyft. You just download the app, you request a driver, and they show up 3.5 minutes later on average. It's really that fast. Now, every Lyft driver is fully vetted through their 10-point safety standard, including criminal and DMV background checks, so you know you're going to get around quickly and safely. Lyft drivers are rated after every ride, so only the best ones stick around. You don't have to worry about getting into a filthy car with some creepy dude, no. With Lyft, you can tip in the app, too, and this obviously leads to happier drivers. 9 out of 10 Lyft rides get a perfect 5-star rating for the passenger. It's just a better all-around experience, really. But you see, bigger isn't always better. Lyft isn't the biggest ride-sharing app, but it's the fastest-growing, and it's the highest-rated. And I'm talking quality over quantity. Thanks to Lyft, you've got an easy way to avoid drunk driving. You never have to bum a ride. You never have to worry about parking. You know, a lot of people are actually getting rid of their cars and relying on Lyft to get around. And you know what? Can't say I blame them in some of these cities. Right now, Lyft is offering you, the listener, a special deal. You can get 3 free rides up to $10 each. That's a $30 value when you use the promo code Ricochet. So download the free Lyft app today, enter the promo code Ricochet in the payment section, and you'll start with 3 free rides up to $10 each, a $30 value. That's promo code Ricochet. Enter promo code Ricochet, and we thank Lyft for sponsoring this, the Ricochet Podcast. Now we head off to our first guest here, James Rosen. That's right. He's the Fox News Chief Washington Correspondent and editor of the New York Times bestseller, A Torch Kept Lit by William F. Buckley, Jr. Welcome to the podcast, sir. So you're in D.C. What's different exactly about covering this administration versus, say, the Obama administration?
Well, the president tweets a lot more. There's just for openers. We've seen almost a barrage of executive orders that is quite atypical for this period in a new presidency. All in all, it's been very different in more ways than we have time here to count, probably.
Well, what's the atmosphere, the tone, the mood? From what I get, it sounds like the press corps is alienated, spiky, clammy, unhappy, and all of a sudden thrust into this adversarial role. Is this what you feel? Is this what you actually are detecting, or is this just sort of what we're being told? It's like
you want real sociology. I will give it to you.
Yes.
Beltway sociology. There is a kind of a movement afoot, inchoate but still discernible, on the part of the mainstream media, to use new terminology for this president that they previously have eschewed in their coverage of presidents, even presidents who have been demonstrably found to have lied publicly. And so we're seeing a more frequent use of the word lie in a New York Times headline. The Washington Post the next day did a whole story about Trump's, quote, total disregard for the truth. The fair question to ask in these circumstances, and you certainly know this from your own books that you've written about the way information works and so forth, is if it's true, as we've all said in abundant detail about Donald Trump, that he represents a kind of a new paradigm for modes of communication and for for conduct, for the way he comports himself. He's totally different from all the presidents who have preceded him. If that's true, wouldn't it be a natural response on the part of the news media to seek to develop some new way to cover this new phenomenon and not necessarily rely on the AP style book approach that worked for so long with conventional politicians? That would be understandable. The question is if the conclusion being reached by the media right now, to use the word lie in a headline and so forth, if that is the correct remedy for dealing with such a unique character as Donald Trump. The fascinating thing to me about watching him through the campaign and through the present day is that Mr. Trump seems openly to express his liberation from something that is otherwise governing for all other politicians. And that is the imperative that which one says on Tuesday should roughly accord with that which one says on Wednesday. And Mr. Trump has never seemed beholden to that imperative. And if in the world of politics, that can be quite liberating indeed. So the question is, how do the news media cover such an interesting and unconventional figure? But I'm not sure branding the L word is the way to go about it.
James. Oh, go ahead, Larry.
No, I'm sorry. James, this reminds me a little bit of Richard Nixon. I mean, they seem to make a fetish about fighting the media. Now, apart from the Watergate business, it started, you know, right at the beginning, and Nixon had pretty much terrible relations with the press down through the years. However, you know, he won two elections, the second one by a landslide. So I guess I'm asking you, how important is this, Trump versus the media? Absence of terms, policies, and also in political terms, election.
In substantive terms, a preoccupation with what one considers to be dishonest news coverage has to be simply, as a matter of simple arithmetic, distracting, because it is not in and of itself a policy agenda item. And so the more time and oxygen and energy that Mr. Trump and his aides spend prosecuting some kind of war, just or otherwise, with the news media, the less time that leaves for the pursuit of their actual policy agenda items from infrastructure onward. And so as a political matter, though, which was the other half of the coin that you brandished, Larry, as a political matter, I think there may be some gain in it, but it's usually only short term because, again, the people, too, are preoccupied with the policy agenda. That's why they put Donald Trump in office.
Yeah. So in other words, if we spend 2 days arguing about the size of the crowd, you're not getting your message through. On the other hand, if we get rid of that size of the crowd, you do get your message through. And as I said earlier, Trump has had a pretty energetic and, in my view at least, a pretty successful first week of taking actions very much in accord with how he ran and won. So I guess what you're saying is stay on message. That would be the better strategy for the Trump crowd.
Right. I mean, the strict question you asked was whether there's a prosecution of a war with the media, again, whether it's considered to be a just war or not, how that factors into the policy agenda and the politics. And the answer is it can only be a distraction from the policy agenda in pure arithmetic of time and energy. But where there is political gain, I usually think that it's only short term, because, again, the voters want results. They care less about Katie Turr than they do about their bridges, their roads, their infrastructure, their health care, the immigration policy, and so on.
James, this is John Gabriel. And let's talk about your book, A Torch Kept Lit, Great Lives of the 20th Century. It's a collection of obituaries by William F. Buckley. And as we have the media warring against Trump and vice versa, it's a breath of fresh air just reading Mr. Buckley. Why did he so many obits?
Well, of course, William F. Buckley Jr., whose extraordinary career I think requires no introduction for this audience, was first and foremost a man of God, a deeply devout Catholic. And I think that his penchant for writing eulogies, even though the eulogy, strictly speaking, is not a formal part of the Catholic funeral mass, Buckley understood that service to the patrimony, which was the sort of corpus of collected truths that millennia of mankind's experience have passed down, serving the patrimony requires bearing witness to great lives. Great with a lowercase g, of course, in a sense, because there are some very evil people that for whom William F. Buckley saw the need to bear witness. But these are epic lives in some sense. And you're very good to mention the book. I'm pleased to tell you that A Torch Kept Lit spent 5 weeks on the New York Times bestseller list. I returned William F. Buckley to the place where he used to say he maintains a small apartment, which was the New York Times bestseller list. And it hit Amazon top five. And I think for the very reasons you suggested, which was that in such a toxic political climate as we endured in 2016, there was a real hunger on the part of the electorate and I think the book buying public for a period of greater wit and civility in our politics, as William F. Buckley exemplified.
In compiling all these obituaries, and he's such a fascinating writer, when I was going through the obituaries, and also if I was you researching all the obituaries, I would get distracted from the task at hand and just read and read and read, because you kind of can't stop reading Buckley. But what was your favorite obituary that you came across?
Well, some were more challenging than others. For example, the obituaries, the eulogies he wrote for Winston Churchill and Martin Luther King Jr. are both highly critical, surprisingly so. Given how thoroughly Churchill is lionized today in conservative circles, and of course, given the sort of gauzy remembrance of Martin Luther King that we have as a society. I'm a huge Beatles fan, so I loved what he had to say about John Lennon and Jerry Garcia, for that matter, even again where he might be critical. I think the eulogy for Ronald Reagan, which was actually delivered when former President Reagan was in his declining stages, is truly one of the most moving, because there was a real friendship there. And of course, as we know, Ronald Reagan said that William F. Buckley Jr. was the most influential journalist. Their bond was very deep.
Let's go to something that's been causing great distress, and that is apparently the obituary that Steve Bannon wrote for Freedom of the Press. That sounds big, right?
That was a sucker punch there. In radio terms, that was a sucker punch.
Sorry, doing my best. So everyone, according to the New York Times story here, is reared up on their with horror and alarm over the "shut up" comment. Do you think that's being correctly reported? I think what he said was "shut up and listen." Was that it? Not just "shut up," period, but "shut up for a while." People are tired of it.
We might regard that any command or injunction to another individual to shut up carries with it implicitly the additional injunction to listen. So saying "shut up and listen" is almost redundant. But of course, no one really imagines that the news media as an entity, if it can be spoken of at all, is possible of shutting up, because the precise business in which it's engaged is piping up, not shutting up. No one's going to willingly self-deport, as it were, and just shut up. But I think that Bannon here, with these comments to this newspaper at this time, establishes himself perhaps as the premier media bias critic since the first time anyone of any prominence really raised that issue, which was Vice President Spiro Agnew in 1969.
Nattering nabobs of negativism.
A very memorable speech in Iowa, I believe, in November 1969, about how elite groups of men in certain coastal cities were controlling the entire flow of news. And, of course, that again, as Larry said, it's reminiscent of the Nixon administration in that sort of direct combat with the press. The press landscape, of course, is very different from Richard Nixon's day, too.
James, just your take on the role of Steve Bannon in this administration. He has plenty of access to the president. He's one of the top three or four or five people. How do you see Bannon? Besides the media war, and I'm sure he's going to keep that up, I would reckon he's going to lead the culture war. I would also reckon he's going to lead the so-called nationalist populist war. What's your impression of Bannon's role?
I'm obliged to begin with a number of throat-clearing exercises to the effect, first, number one, that I've never met Mr. Bannon. Number two, that the person most closely covering this administration for us at Fox News is not me. It's our estimable chief White House correspondent, John Roberts. However, just speaking about Bannon, first, in the broadest terms, we are also obliged to observe that as a staff aide, in essence, to the president of the United States, this particular individual is going to be but one individual in an aggregation of them assembled by that chief executive. And inevitably, the personality of that chief executive in whatever field of human endeavor, whether it's a White House or a large corporation or what have you. And of course, we're seeing perhaps a fusing of those cultures in Donald Trump. The personality of that individual at the top of this hierarchical sort of arrangement inevitably infuses and informs the actions and the conduct of the people around him. So Steve Bannon's going to be serving President Donald Trump. Donald Trump, as a specific chief executive, is a mercurial fellow and someone who is reported by those who know him well to be susceptible to the dynamic in which he acts on the advice of the person from whom he has heard most recently. And in this particular West Wing, it seems very crowded to me, insofar as you have Reince Priebus as the chief of staff, who I understand in his own mind believes himself to enjoy the primacy that chiefs of staff traditionally have. You also have Jared Kushner, who perhaps exercises singular influence with the president. You have still others, Kellyanne Conway and so on. So it's a very crowded field. And Bannon's role, I think, is going to reflect this somewhat chaotic arrangement that President Trump has fashioned here. And so will he even be the Steve Bannon that people knew him to be until now, if he's constrained by a kind of chaotic system in some way, or too many cooks in the kitchen, if you will? So I wonder what his role will be. I think it will change. I think they're all going to be putting out a lot of fires, and I think they're all going to be in competition with each other to some extent.
James, last question, and it's an important one for these times, I think. Do you have a Trump impersonation yet?
I'm ashamed that I do. In fact, I find it hard to suppress it. Look, believe me, no, wrong. What am I going to do? Okay, believe me. If you say rip up the deal, I'm a deals guy, okay? But I will tell you, I will police that contract so tough they won't stand a chance. That's my best shot.
I am seeing you with your thumb and forefinger pressed together.
Connected. The other hands are, believe me, the other hands are right where they're supposed to be. They want to be totally appropriate with the hands.
Wait.
Did Obama, just in the interest of bipartisanship, I also did Obama. The notion that I or someone on my staff would extend a sentence. And extend it some more to no real end is false. It's made up. So, I try to keep it bipartisan.
Oh,
What about it? It's going to be great. It's going to be the greatest thing ever. You'll see. It's going to be just great. It's going to be fabulous.
Larry, I know you a long time, Larry. Believe me. And I'm going to tell you something else. Believe me. Listen, I am unusual. I wouldn't say unusual, but let's just say in you asked, we began our conversation with a discussion of sort of the press climate here. I don't regard it as a luxury that is available to me to accord myself that I can relinquish all notion of objectivity about Donald Trump or that he represents something so negative on the American political landscape that I have to adjust my behavior. To me, he's the president, and I'm going to cover him the same way I covered the last president and the president before that and the president before that. because that's what I'm supposed to do. That's my actual job. For those reporters who feel differently, it's just they seem to think that they have more options than I seem to see as open for myself.
That's why we watch and that's why we read. James Rosen, you can watch him on Fox, and of course you can read his new collection of Buckley's essays. Thanks for joining us in the podcast today, sir. It's been a pleasure.
You were very kind to me. Thank you.
You know, the thing in the Bannon story, the New York Times, Bannon describes himself as Darth Vader, which is odd, because if you think of how Darth Vader ended up, he threw his boss down a hole. So if you want to think in the future of Steve Bannon picking up an aged Donald Trump who's been shooting lightning bolts at people and throwing them down the hole, that's probably not how he sees things going for him. And of course, Star Wars is back with Rogue One. Darth Vader is back being the Darth of yore, the fearsome character, not the... Well, what was the last thing we saw of Darth Vader in the movies? I think he was being burned, right? They died and they laid him on the slab and they gave him a Viking funeral and the rest of it. And that didn't look too comfortable. You kind of hope that Darth wasn't awake for that. But if you're not comfortable when you're lying down, you might want to think about what kind of bed you got. Is it a rocky bed heaped with flammables for your funeral? Or is it just feel that uncomfortable because it's some old expensive creaky thing? Get a Casper. Casper, you know this brand. It's the sleep brand created to give you one perfect mattress, and it's sold directly to you, the consumer. They eliminate commission-driven inflated prices. It's got an award-winning sleep surface designed in-house by Casper. It's got a sleek design, and it's delivered in a small, why the heck did they do that, kind of box. You open it up, and it emerges. In addition to the mattress, though, Casper also offers their adaptive pillow and soft, breathable sheets. The whole package can come to you. Now, the mattress industry, they have forced consumers into paying notoriously high markups, right? You know that. I mean, Casper has revolutionized this industry by cutting the cost of dealing with resellers and showrooms and all that overhead and passing the savings directly on to you. An in-house team of engineers spent thousands of hours developing the Casper supportive memory foam that offers a sleep surface that's got just the right sink when you get into it and just the right bounce to hold you up. And plus, its breathable sleep design keeps you cool all night by regulating your temperature throughout the evening. Now, buying a Casper, completely risk-free. They offer free delivery and free returns with 100 nights in between for your home trial. But you're not going to return it. No, you won't. If you don't love it, well, they'll pick it up and they'll refund you everything. But you won't, because Casper understands the importance of truly sleeping on a mattress before you commit, especially considering you're going to spend a third of your life on this. So it's obsessively engineered at a shockingly fair price. That's what you want. Time magazine named it one of the best inventions of 2015, and it's now the most awarded mattress of the decade. Free shipping and returns to U.S. and Canada. 100-night risk-free trial in your own home. If you don't love it, they'll pick it up and give you back all your money. So get $50 off any mattress purchase by visiting Casper.com/ricochet and using the coupon code Ricochet as your promo code. And our thanks to Casper for sponsoring this, the Ricochet Podcast. Well, what, John, is on your mind? I believe you had a piece in the Arizona Republic the other day. I think you were giving sage advice to people on the other side, right?
Well, yeah, most of our newspapers and our Metro dailies have they are not the center right audience per se. So I've just heard a lot of panic and concern and alarm about how Trump is going to ruin our lives and he's going to take away our rights. And how will we possibly live with this man as our president? And basically, my point was simply, if you fear that Trump will destroy your life, maybe take away power from the federal government in general. I live in the Mountain West. I'm out in Arizona, of course, and we always have kind of felt far off from Washington, and we chafe at all the federal lands that are owned. So much of Arizona, especially Nevada, is owned so much by the federal government. And anytime a rancher wants to expand his property or somebody wants to put in a new home development, the federal government is there to put the kibosh on that. So I think this is a good lesson for especially people, left of center people, and many moderates who supported Obama and cheered as he bragged about his pen and a phone. Well, now Trump has that power. So maybe you should reconsider. And if California doesn't like the Trump agenda, well, why don't you employ federalism and start pushing for states to be able to make a lot of the decisions that should be made on a more local level? So it seems obvious to many of us that this is the case, but sometimes people only learn through hard, brutal experience.
Larry, do you think that'll take, that the lessons will be learned, bred deep into the bone, and the next time the Democrats have the power, that they'll refrain from using the instruments of the government to get their points across?
No.
No.
Not a chance.
No, of course not.
Yeah, I know, it's a fool's errand. It's it's like telling me not to touch the wet paint when the sign is placed there. But give it a college try.
You know, look where they are. I mean, look, I wouldn't mind that if they learned something from this election, but I don't see any evidence of that. It may develop over time. It just occurs to me, though, with regard to Trump's messaging, and, you know, he's taking criticism on the right for abrogating constitutional powers. Senator Lee, for example, has already raised this issue. I believe Senator Cruz has already hinted at this issue. If you traditionally, my experience, if you're a political leader, in this case president, who is touting lower taxes, fewer regulations, shifting powers, including budget powers, from the federal government to the states, to me, that's a limited government signal, and that shows the guy is not power hungry and he's not going to break the Constitution. And in fact, I would add to that his likely judicial appointments, which all seem to fall into, you know, something like that category, the Scalia model, which was certainly a limited government model. I mean, I think a lot of people misunderstand Donald Trump. I guess that's really my bottom line. Some of that is his, you know, he's a different, his rhetoric is different, his style of communications is different. I understand all that. Sometimes there's too much me, 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 I. But really, look at the policy substance. To me, this is a guy who wants to curb the power of government, not expand the power of government. Now, that may not always be the case, but even including Obamacare, it seems to me that that is the majority of the case that he's making. And as his policies unfold, I think this limited government message is going to unfold.
Because he's not been placed in the limited government context intellectually. People were saying that the GOP had now become the party of, I mean, Hugh Hewitt, our friend, has got himself a book, The Fourth Way, in which the fourth way that he talks about is one that uses government uses statism to accomplish some big things. And that's sort of an inevitable adjustment that we all have to make, because that's what a lot of people want, isn't it? I mean, a lot of people say they have no hope whatsoever that the federal Leviathan is going to shrink. They just want it to be perhaps more effective in getting their things done. Like if Trump says, hey, we're going to have better airports, you think anybody's going to complain? Larry, you're in New York. The airports that he's talking about are some of the ones out there, LaGuardia, JFK. Do you think he's going to make any converts if all of a sudden Donald Trump starts improving the airport experience for New Yorkers?
Well, look, LaGuardia is a big mess, but that, I don't see that. That's a different – look, infrastructure, if it's genuine positive infrastructure that makes the roads, bridges, tunnels, energy, electricity grid, et cetera, if it makes all that better – I don't see why that's statism. What I see there is a policy. And yeah, the federal government will finance part of the policy, but ironically, a lot of that infrastructure policy is going to be done through the private sector. You know, particularly anything to do with energy and power, that's going to be funded by private companies, not the federal government. Look, Obamacare. The whole point of reforming Obamacare or rewriting and changing Obamacare is not bigger government. He doesn't want single payer, at least so far as I can tell. He doesn't want single payer. He doesn't want nationalized medicine. He wants to protect patients. He wants choice. He wants competition. He wants health savings accounts. Those are all small government ideas which increase the empowerment of individual people. And with tax cuts, I go back to that. Show me a president who genuinely wants lower marginal tax rates, and I'll show you a limited government president. And I think that's been lost in this whole discussion. Furthermore, although it hasn't received the attention I think it's going to, at the beginning of the week, over the weekend, as I recall, the Trump transition released a budget plan which had $10.5 trillion in spending restraint over the next 10 years. Now, you can argue whether that's doable or possible in the politics. I understand that. But as a matter of intention to show his political ideological position, if you're going to cut $10 trillion out of the federal budget in the next decade, that is not big government. That is smaller government. And so I go down the laundry list. Things like immigration may not fall as easily into one category or another. But if you're saying that we need a national border and that that's always been part of our constitutional system, we're an autonomous country, is that big government or small government? It seems to me that's government policy that is moving us in the right direction, assuming it's done to my taste, which so far not bad. So I don't know. I don't. This idea of Trump as Hitler or Trump as some massive, power-hungry megalomaniac, Trump's going to rule the country, I don't see it. I mean, perhaps sometimes his rhetoric gets ahead of the policy, the way James Rosen was kidding us. That was a great mimicry. But I don't. Where's this big government case? Show me a particular policy where he wants to clearly expand the role of the government.
No, I get what you're saying. I was thinking in terms – whenever somebody starts talking about trains, how we need trains, that to me is a big warning flag that they're going to spend a lot of government money on pointless trains that go from places that people don't want to go to and aren't going to be ridden by nobody. And I think it's just a general –
That's not what he's saying. But that's not what he's saying. See, that's a very important point. High-speed bullet trains to nowhere, bridges to nowhere. I don't think that's where he's going on this.
I think he was talking about trains. I mean, there's an admiration for the nice, sleek trains that people have in other countries. But I'll concede that point. And I think your point is fine. It's good and it's right and it's accurate. I'm working on an impression of somebody who wanted to use the levers of state power, be it the pen and the phone, the executive action, whatever, to accomplish things. It didn't make me worry about Hitler. It made me worry about FDR. But again, I may be wrong. I'm going to look at something good here and ask John to talk about it. And that is, we've already had Miami say, you know what, we're going to back away from the sanctuary city thing. And we've already had the Homeland Security informed, you guys are a law enforcement agency. You know it. We're going to let you do it. We're going to stop, catch, and release. John, you're in a part of the country that's affected a lot by immigration. How is this playing?
I think it's playing quite well. And basically a lot of, once again, the panic in the media. Donald Trump is saying, hey, I have an idea. Why don't we enforce the laws that are already on the books?
Right.
He's not.
He has not. Good for you.
He has not signed any legislation changing the way we do things, but he says, border patrol, you're supposed to stop immigration. You can go back to doing that now, since that's why you exist. I actually visited the border and the border fence in a tiny little town called Naco, Arizona, and its Mexican counterpart as well down in southern Arizona. And yeah, there was a large fence there and Border Patrol was working and doing their jobs and everybody was content and happy. And what concerns me, living probably, say, 150 miles from the border, is just making sure that the laws to which the Congress passed, to which the president signed, and to which all of us agreed to, is enforced. And I don't think that is too much to ask. I have our history in Arizona. We once were Mexico. We have a great amount of Hispanic influence on our culture, thank God, on our food, since my family comes from the Midwest, not too far from you, James. Hmm. And it is good to have that diversity. I think Dennis Miller once said, I don't mind you coming into my country, but would you mind signing the guest book on the way in? And I think it's great that he just wants to enforce the laws that are already on the book. We can have the debates on immigration reform when those come down the pike. But I think the American people and I think most Democrats were sick of Obama just deciding which laws he wanted to enforce and which ones he wanted to ignore, because it helped his case if he could allow dreamers and just not enforce the law among certain groups who he
didn't. You think Democrats hated that? I have the feeling that they absolutely loved it. It's the whole dream of the borderless, transnational, cosmopolitan world in which nationalities fade away and everybody's suffused with this great glow of kumbaya, we're in it together. I think they hated. I think they're hating what Trump does because it is a resurgence of nationalism, which they regard with horror. I mean, when he signs something about the inauguration day being a day of patriotic devotion or something like that, it was like a cross and a garlic to vampires. The idea of patriotism and nationalism are anathema to a lot of these people.
I think they have that revulsion, but that's kind of, let's say, the Davos class. If you're a university professor, yes, tear down any kind of wall, any kind of border. But I'm talking about the Democratic voters who voted for Obama 8 years ago and voted for Trump this time. I always use my sister as an example. She is maybe slight to the left leaning moderate, and she voted for Obama the first time around. 4 years later, she voted for Romney because we live in Arizona, and she saw what he was doing. And immigration was a small part of that. How he hamstrung businesses locally was a much larger part. But she's someone who is persuadable. And that's kind of her perspective. She has no problem with immigration. You know, she would love to increase immigration, legal immigration, and control the borders. I think for the average voter, if you are not in a very specific group of people running the party or voting for the party on that one issue, I think that's why the Democrats lost so many, you know, what we used to call the Reagan Democrats in throughout the Rust Belt. People are
Larry,
saying,
what's
happening to our border is part of that problem.
These new voters, Larry, are they Trumps to lose?
Well, they probably are Trumps to lose. They're also Trumps to win and transform the political scene. And I just want to echo, you know, enforcing the constitutional rule of law, at least I don't regard that as a statist action. I regard that as an appropriate action for government. And furthermore, Trump has just spent the better part of the last week overturning Obama's executive orders, which many people believe were unconstitutional or darn close to the line. So if you've got a guy who's trying to enforce the rule of law, and he may have to go into Chicago on top of that, or down to the border, or you got a guy who's sitting in the Oval Office overturning Obama's executive orders, which many people believed completely usurped our constitutional traditions, I don't regard that as statist.
No, neither do I. Neither do I.
Quite the contrary.
I don't either. I've just been listening to so many of Trump's supporters who clearly and gleefully define themselves as economic nationalists and who believe that a certain sort of muscular statism is necessary to achieve certain economic and cultural goals. That's all I'm saying. I'm saying this is what I'm hearing from a lot of the people who are the serious intellectual defenders of Trump, not from you. But Larry, you're in New York. And again, I can't not imagine that heads are exploding when sanctuary cities are not only going to be taken off the table, but there's going to be registries and announcements on a quarterly basis of the amount of crime done by people coming in from other countries. Again, this is something we haven't seen before. Do you think that's necessary? Do you think it's a good corrective that it repays us for years of having such things obscured and denied?
I do. I favor it. I think sanctuary cities are awful. I think, you know, releasing criminal aliens is absurd with great human cost to life. So let's go to the books. Let's look at the laws. And in this case, I believe there's a very strong case that all Trump is trying to do is enforce the laws. And I am all for it. I mean, I'm not a guy who's ever in favor of house-to-house deportation. But to me, the sanctuary city business is completely different. And I got to tell you, I'm waiting to see what kind of follow-through the president has, you know, regarding this remarkable Chicago development. I mean, it's catastrophic what's going on in Chicago. It looks to me like that great city, I happen to love Chicago, but that great city is almost at the point where they are incapable of self-rule. And they have a mayor who has no interest in that. And all they want to do is attack Trump and flaunt Trump and oppose Trump. Meanwhile, that great city is literally destroying itself on a daily basis. Now, if he brings in the National Guard or some such, people will say, oh, my God, this is a statist action. Well, okay, I suppose you could have said that when, you know, JFK brought the guard into to Arkansas and the Southern segregation battles and things of that sort. I just think this is upholding the rule of law. And if a municipality cannot govern itself, you know, like in New York in the 1970s, we couldn't govern ourselves. So guess what? We had to set up financial control boards, and the governance temporarily was taken away out of the hands of the elected politicians because they were incapable of doing their jobs. Now, maybe that's too much federal intervention for some people, but I think it worked out pretty well. And Trump's a guy, you know, he's a man of action. He sees this thousands of killings, most of which are black on black, not all, but most. And he sees this city destroying itself. He may believe that it is incumbent on him to keep law and order and safety. And that is one of the first goals of government, is it not?
Well, again, you've used the words that horrify people, law and order, because they, especially in the Chicago context. Why? That's just simply another term for police violence. But you're right. What I'm interested to see is the pushback to the quarterly announcements of crime by illegal aliens, because people will say it's meaningless. The Chicago stats really are meaningless because crime in general is going down. That's what they'll always tell you. But in my neighborhood, for example, which is a very safe neighborhood, all of a sudden crime spiked because there was a crew that was going around from house to house to house. And wouldn't you know it, a lot of the people who themselves were saying crime's going down, I'm a good progressive, we should not put them in prison, all of a sudden were flooding the local message boards with questions about security systems. Odd how that works. Now, if any of those people...
You know, we had this...
Larry, stop. Whoa. See, this is a commercial, Larry.
I'm sorry. I panicked. I just had to tell you.
I know.
I'm out.
What I was going to say is if any of these people have been to the Consumer Electronics Show, they would have noted something quite amazing. That's the big trade show for all the gigas and the gadgets and the stuff. And a lot of these things are fun and toys, but some of these things are useful and ingenious. SimpliSafe Home Security was at CES, the electronics show, and they had one of the most talked about products on the show. It's the new SimpliSafe Security Camera. What does it do? Well, it connects to the sensors in your alarm system. So if an intruder tries to break in, the camera automatically starts recording. And then not only will the SimpliSafe call the police, but you'll have the evidence. So when the police arrive, you can say, here's the tape, here's the guy. It's incredible. You can check into your home anytime, by the way. Just live stream HD footage directly to your smartphone. I like to prop mine up and just have it playing away at work. You hear the dog bark and wonder what's going on. It's a great way to just keep up on what is happening around your house and feel safe. Plus, with SimpliSafe, this is important. There are no expensive long-term contracts. We used to have a system. I dreaded it. They hiked it up at a regular basis until I finally said no, and then I felt naked and vulnerable. Well, don't feel that way. Don't be that way. If you want to see for yourself what SimpliSafe's brilliant technology can do for your home, visit simplisafe.com/ricochet. It's spelled SimpliSafe.com/ricochet. You'll even get the special 10% discount, but that's only at simplisafe.com/ricochet. Well, gentlemen, before we go, let's see. What were we to discuss? What with Larry on, it's hard ever to say that nothing has been – we've covered everything because Larry just covers everything, the waterfront, the politics, industries. And it always makes me feel incredibly optimistic. That's the great thing about these conversations. Larry, you know, you can turn the world on with your smile. Let's just put it that way.
Well, of course, in the newsroom at CNBC, they call me the happy warrior. I'm actually proud of that, and I am optimistic. By the way, some breaking news as we talk. Mm-hmm. President Trump just completed an hour-long phone call with Mexican President Peña Nieto. And I just want to say I don't know the contents of that call. They have not yet been divulged. We'll wait for Sean Spicer, presumably later in the day. But here's a case, much to Trump's credit, where he sees things kind of slipping out of control and the rhetoric is bad. And I don't really believe Trump wants a war against Mexico. So he's trying to put out that fire and perhaps go back to a statesmanlike head of state deal-making mode and try to work some things out rather than just to have, you know, bric-a-bracs through tweets. And I think that's a very good thing. And if I'm right about this, it shows that people are underestimating the size and scope of Trump's understanding of how things work and how they can be fixed. So I like that.
Well, John, let me ask you this. When I saw the whole meeting is off, Trump walks away, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and I was looking at the long faces around various places, newsrooms and otherwise, about how this is just, it's all going to hell, I thought, no, this is probably just a negotiating thing. This is staking an extreme position out here so then everybody can get together over here.
That's exactly, I mean, it's part of the deal. He made his opening offer, essentially, and now he's negotiating with an hour phone call. I think it's going to be going back and forth for a while, and I think that Trump and Peña Nieto's hope is just to make sure that it's somehow mutually beneficial. Hopefully they'll get a situation that helps out both countries. I don't see the need to punish Mexico or for them to punish us. I know that Trump is not a big NAFTA fan, but there are a lot of issues to discuss, and I hope it can be mutually beneficial. But his first statement is for Trump is always the beginning of the negotiation. So I don't think we need to panic yet. And completely off topic, I am not the segue master like yourself, sir, but I watched your video about Mary Tyler Moore visiting the various places that were in for opening. And it's one of those – it's one of those deaths that hits me personally in a way. I'm seeing now, before it was like someone like Bob Hope would die. And I'm like, okay, that was kind of my parents' or even grandparents' generation. People I grew up with are passing away. And since you're in Minneapolis, you've already lost Prince last year. Mm-hmm. What did Mary Tyler Moore mean to your city?
Well, it's interesting. As I say in the video, she didn't live here. She came here, did a couple of walk-arounds here for the show. But created this character who, of course, lived here and made this city feel pretty damn proud about itself. Minneapolis was a different place when she came here than it was when she left. We'd grown up an awful lot, and we really appreciated the chance that the show showed Minneapolis to the world. This is also when our culture was getting attention for, you know, Wendy Anderson on the cover of Time, famously holding up a walleye or a muskie or something. And the good life in Minnesota was how Time put it, because we'd struck this bargain. We'd come up with this Minnesota deal. Everybody was going to be fine with high taxes as long as we got good services, which we did. And the companies were going to be good corporate citizens and give 10% of their money to charities, which they did, et cetera, et cetera. And it worked because you generally had a Scandinavian social capital accumulation. You had people who were perfectly happy to pay the high taxes because they were getting something in return, and they didn't believe that people were gaming the system. That's why that kind of Nordic socialism works up there. It worked here as well. It wouldn't last. But there was a period there when that show was on where the old Minneapolis, with a lot of its old names and television personalities and fixtures like the stadiums and the rest of it, was giving way to a new culture. And it was a very exciting time. And we saw ourselves reflected in that show for better and for worse. So it was marvelous. I mean, I don't think that Laura Petrie meant a lot to New Rochelle, but Mary Tyler Moore and Mary Richards meant a lot to Minneapolis. So the video, though, if you want to go look at it, it's posted under Peter Robinson's site. When we found out that she died, the newsroom has to go into overdrive, and we have to accumulate the stuff that we've already written. We didn't have a video, so they just said, go do something. So, okay, I wish I'd had a haircut. I wish I'd known. You walk there thinking what you're going to say, and then you set up the sticks and point at the cameraman and start talking. And you got about 30 minutes, 40 minutes to come up with something before you're done. So it was on the fly, but somebody said, did you do that in advance? And I said, no, but I had 35 years to think about it, I think.
Well, I'm hoping that at her funeral, someone in the back row starts uncontrollably giggling. Yeah, that would be the perfect homage to her with the Chuckles the Clown episode. After watching your video, I watched about three episodes on YouTube back to back. And just growing up, watching with my mom and dad, my dad was essentially Bob Newhart. So we had watched Mary Tyler Moore and Bob Newhart. And it was good to see that when writing was actually very, very good back then, too. I was impressed how well it held up.
In about season three, it really kicks in. Three through five are just some of the best sitcom writing you'll find. We also lost Mike Touch Connors. Mike Connors, Mannix, in one of the greatest themes also of that era. Mike was very much a 60s guy when he played Mannix, right? That was not a 70s, kippy, kind of sensitive guy. The Mannix character was the sort of guy that Don Draper would have sized up right away as somebody that he couldn't BS. There was a directness to him. There was a humor to him. And by the time the show ended, Mannix ended, we were done with those kinds of 70s guys, right? Or those kind of 60s archetypes, right?
It seemed like we were. I think as the world continued to spin out of control, it was good to see a no-nonsense guy like that. And that's why you had every show that wasn't a sitcom on in the 70s was a detective show. And usually this one's in the wheelchair. This one's overweight. This one's very elderly. And they all had their special spin on it. But I think and then you had the Death Wish and Dirty Harry movies, too. I think there was a large segment of the population saying, OK, we need a new sheriff in town, someone to take control.
And those were all about the side of the game. Yeah.
I realize I'm in the company of some very high level intellectual cognoscenti here. It's way above my pay grade. But I just want to note, I knew Mary Tyler Moore a fair piece, actually, down through the years in New York. And I'm just desperately searching my brain. I don't recall the conversation with her about Nordic socialism. I want to work through that. Maybe I missed something, but I just don't recall that. I mean, what you had there, she's a wonderful lady, by the way, with a very strong character, and was a great friend to many people in New York City in her private life. She's just kind of like, you know, an ordinary Midwest gal, was a good actress, great sense of humor, probably never took life all that seriously. She's just like the gal next door. And in that sense, it's a role model. And I wish we hadn't lost her, because we need lots more role models just like her.
Well, I think the Mary Tyler Moore episode, where it was nothing but a 30-minute debate with Milton Friedman on Bastiat, was perhaps my second favorite episode.
You guys, I love all of you.
Oh,
fabulous. Oh, I love you all.
Milt.
I love you all.
Oh, Mr. Hayek. We're out of here. Hey, everybody, this podcast was brought to you by Lyft, by Casper Mattresses, and by Simply Safe. You can use the coupon code Ricochet at all those places and save money, sleep better, get around, and be safe. Ooh, what a great way to live. Thanks to Ricochet. And by the way, at the Ricochet store, you can find branded swag so you can swan about town and proudly sport that logo. If you enjoyed the show, would you please maybe go over to iTunes? You know, if you give a nice review and some stars, it helps other listeners discover us, which keeps the show going and keeps Ricochet going. Join up. Be one of the 1,500 new members they were looking for in the next couple of months or so. Thanks for listening. Larry, thank you as ever for being Rob. John, thank you for being Peter. I'm Jeff. Being me, alas. And you, folks, well, we'll see you in the comments at Ricochet 3.0.
Join the conversation.